Whatever the trigger might be, if you can reproduce it again and again in the same way, it habituates. And the more eager you are to push up on your anxiety while doing that, the more quickly it habituates. So I think that this gets people then ready to be daring, to be like ready to take on more and more challenges. And that's the most beautiful thing you see when you actually do exposure therapy with people in this brutal way of just having them, you know, find a trigger and reproduce it till the anxiety is gone. They get this incredible sense of like, wow, I could do this. This has been holding me back for so long. I can do this with anything. And sometimes you have people then that really progress to the next level on their own. And that next level is daring, where now they're just eager to keep the alarm sounding so that they can keep practicing it.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimorc.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass, which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimalwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, great to be back.
Yeah, Kevin. Well, we're doing some exciting work on the new course on anxiety, soon to be released, of course. And I thought we could do in a three-episode series on some of the topics that we've been discussing there and working through. And so the first one is about engaging challenges and embracing fear. So how does that sound for a topic today?
Hey, I think it sounds great.
Awesome.
It's a topic near and dear to my heart.
That's right. This is, yes, this course is kind of your baby here, I think.
Yeah.
So let's see. I guess maybe just to zoom out a little bit and to give some background for all three here, just background on anxiety. So the first question is just to try to understand why anxiety is on the rise today. Is it just because we're measuring it more and more people are coming out with that they have anxiety, or is there like a real actual increase in the incidence of anxiety?
I think that there is a real increase in the incidence because we've been actually checking the incidence of these things for a long time now. And so it's not simply some kind of reporting artifact. We actually know that people are feeling a lot more anxious. It's also true though that people are talking about it more openly. I think there used to be more of a stigma about anxiety that people saw it as somehow weak to have it. So they were very shy about talking about it. And now it's just a little bit more open. So maybe on the one hand, like social media is a double-edged sword because on the one hand, it certainly increases anxiety. There's a dose response that as people are spending time on social media, particularly worrying about what people think of them, and worrying if they're liked, and worrying if their posts are liked, that creates a great deal of anxiety in people. But on the other hand, it also helps people to see that anxiety is quite common and normal because people talk about it very openly. I think to answer the question, there's not one thing that I can tell that is the reason that anxiety has increased. I think it's many things that all are congealing together. So the rise of social media is definitely one thing, because in some way, what's new about this media is precisely that it's social. And this increased visibility that people have makes them much more susceptible to shame. And shame is the fear of being disgraced in the eyes of others. And in some ways, I think that is the fuel for all anxiety. So there's a kind of anxiety called social anxiety disorder, where people have a fear of shame. So it's just like the fear of shame is like they're afraid of being embarrassed. They're afraid of like looking bad in the eyes of others, and they're afraid of what other people will think. But I was just telling this to the residents I teach today, that I start to wonder, it's one of my unsolved questions with anxiety, is all anxiety actually social anxiety? Because social anxiety as a disorder has a lot of thoughts, but also has the feeling, you know, of shame, embarrassment that people are so afraid of. It causes huge avoidance. So it's kind of one of these very widespread global things. It's not usually just about how do I look or saying an embarrassing thing in public. But they worry about everything. But then again, when I think of the people that I work with and the times I've had worries myself, I've only, like in my own case, I've worried about things. There's always been an element of, like, let's say a person's afraid of losing their job, you know, which fortunately I've always been self-employed. So that hasn't been, maybe that's why. But if a person's afraid of losing their job, it's usually not the fact of losing the job because they know they could find another job, but there's an embarrassment to losing the job. So even like with catching COVID, people, yeah, you could be afraid of getting the illness. Yeah, people don't want the illness. But at some point there came to be a stigma associated. Like, what did you do wrong? Were you not careful? Were you not masking? Were you not vaccinated? So it became all this social stigma to even catching it or to transmitting it to others. So there's a sense here of like, there's a social element to every form of anxiety, as far as I can tell. And social media has played into that enormously. So that people, you know, whatever happens to them, now if you lose a job, everyone on LinkedIn can tell. So that, and then people worry more about it. But at the other, there's another phenomenon, which is also interesting, which is a kind of apocalyptic fears that people have. That whether it's the climate or it's the political culture or the religious, people feel like there's something apocalyptic happening. And in that sense, and then being through a global pandemic that shut everything down, was apocalyptic. So there's a sense that there's a lot more fear-mongering from people of every political persuasion. You know, and that sense, there's just that degree, which is also multiplied by social media, and that's how it's transmitted in many cases. So it's interesting that this apocalypticism, you know, gets people catastrophically focused. And as that has permeated the culture, anxiety levels keep rising along with it. And in general, convenience of modern life makes people afraid of challenge. And so as things become more and more convenient, we become more and more adverse to challenge itself. We don't see challenges as adversity, you know, that as an adventure actually to be embraced, that you can grow from. But we just see it as something to be mitigated through careful planning and control.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Okay, so I guess you pointed to four factors here. One being the increase. So, well, very interesting to kind of isolate anxiety as having this inherent social dimension. And you mentioned that's, you're kind of pondering that idea now. Is there always this fear of disgrace or this shame at the root of anxiety? And then that gets triggered by social media and the fact that our lives are much more public now than maybe they were at any time. And then the apocalyptic dimension, and then the rise of convenience. Interesting with the kind of apocalyptic element of things that there's obviously a social dimension to that, but it doesn't really seem to be about shame necessarily.
Mm-hmm. But I think the more people can focus on the grand geopolitical, the less they have to focus on the challenges right in front of them, which actually would perhaps bring on more of a greater sense of shame. So that people don't fight the struggle that they could actually win, to fight the struggle that they could actually grow through, but instead then they're preoccupied with things that they can in no way affect.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then you get less practiced in engaging these actual personal daily challenges, and then those become in turn more overwhelming.
Exactly. And then so people go around feeling overwhelmed, which then in fact can give them permission to go more easy on themselves and to not really engage challenge because they're so overwhelmed. And that could be easily a vicious cycle.
Right, right. So then with all this confluence of factors, how do you, well, it seems, how do you help people? I mean, if someone comes to you for help and they you know, say, okay, I have anxiety, what do you start to diagnose these different factors, and how do you go about kind of teasing this out and working with them?
Yeah. So when I'm actually working with someone, I don't really think about these kind of factors at all. It really never enters my mind clinically. My main concern is, how are we going to give them a new experience? Because when people come for therapy, something has triggered them into some kind of active stance, you know, that they feel like they have to make some kind of progress. At least that's what most people, sometimes they just come because their parents or their spouse tell them that they have to come. But for the most part, people are searching for something. And that's an interesting moment to make an impact, because where most people, when it comes to anxiety, are actually living in a state of despair. They don't see how anything can change, and they think this is just the way that they are. Like, I am just afraid of driving. I am just unable to fly on a plane. So when people have deep anxiety, it just becomes a fixed trait. And it can get so fixed that they never consciously even feel anxious. Instead, they could feel annoyance or anger when their rigidity is questioned. They don't see that, in fact, that rigidity is a whole protective structure to protect them from feeling anxiety. So in some ways, the first movement is to help people go from that state of despair to actually being able to feel fear. And that means they have to go from a state of challenge avoidance to challenge engagement. So the first thing that people need to get a taste of is what it's like to lean into a challenge. So to take the trigger, the thing that they're most afraid of, and to find a way to gently lean into it so that they can start to experience the fear directly. Because they think that the fear is a fixed trait of the trigger, and therefore themselves. So I just, you know, I cannot speak in public. You know, or I can't sing in public, or I can't play an instrument in public, you know, or I just cannot, you know, I couldn't run a meeting myself, or whatever it might be. People have all these beliefs that are really just pointing to the trigger that they have, and that they've learned how to structure their life usually pretty successfully to avoid the trigger. Sometimes what happens is, like, I am just not good at heights. I've had people like this. And they're fine until they have a new job and it requires a meeting on the 16th floor in a conference room that is all windows. And now they're exposed to heights and now they're having panic. So then they would come for help. They're like, I have to do something about this. So this is how CBT got started. Taking a trigger and finding a way to reproduce it. A scientific way to reproduce it. And I say scientific because it needs to feel like they can do the exact same triggering again and again and again so that they can experience how it peaks and then goes down the more they try to lean into it. Then the next time they do it, it peaks a little bit less, and the next time less, and the next time less, and the next time less. But so much fun to do exposures with people who have thought that their anxiety would just stay high forever in the presence of this trigger, and to see that all they need to do is treat the trigger as a challenge and engage it instead of avoiding it. Approach the trigger while the alarm is sounding. And that's an experience many of people have never had before. So the original treatment for anxiety was all challenge. And it was just focused on triggers and achieving what we called extinction, which meant that this trigger no longer held a threat label. The threat label had been habituated away through constant approach while the alarm is sounding. So that's the initial phase of how exposure therapy developed. That's really where behavioral therapy came into its own as a treatment. And interestingly, social anxiety was among the first two disorders that were really treated and shown where this approach was shown to work. So you could have people do something that they would find embarrassing, and then it could be reproduced again and again and again until finally they could, sometimes in the very first session, they have this breakthrough where they're amazed that now they're in front of a group and they're talking and there's no anxiety at all because they had gotten through the curve. They had gone up and down as they approached it.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, I think, so that's a great summary. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this is the first of a 3-episode series on anxiety. So we've covered, that's like a great description of the first piece, which is, you could think of it going from despair to fear or the challenge engagement.
No.
Maybe you could just briefly sketch out the other two just so people have kind of the whole context before the future episodes we cover the other two.
Yeah. The entire next wave of treatment, which is also many times the second phase when you're working with an individual, it brings in mindfulness. And it's how do you go through this the safety learning curve where your anxiety initially goes up and as you keep leaning in, it goes down. How do you do that even more efficiently? So once we establish that this works, not only that, but this approach, I would dare say, cannot fail. If you can take a trigger and scientifically reproduce it, find a way to trigger it again and again, it will habituate. Even if it's not healthy to habituate it, you know, you could get comfortable, you know, walking on a beam, you know, with a 1,000-foot drop underneath you. And maybe it's not good to be comfortable doing that, but you could habituate it. Any trigger can be habituated as long as you can reproduce it. Well, once we got good at establishing that, then we started to learn more about like, okay, well, how do we do it better? And that's where mindfulness came in. And mindfulness taught people to then not look at the trigger itself, but at the alarm that's triggered. So, and that gave people a new ability to welcome any trigger. And that gave them a new freedom to welcome anything because in the end, it's all the same. It's just one alarm that you have. You don't have multiple alarms for different types of triggers. There's just one alarm. There's a final common pathway. So if you get good at approaching individual triggers, eventually you get good at the approaching the alarm. So that's the second phase. The third is then what developed the last, which is now that we're understanding how this alarm works, what we see is that in its essence, it's adrenaline. And adrenaline allows us to perform even better at anything we do, as long as we welcome the adrenaline. So this actually added the element of reframing. So reframing anxiety as adrenaline waiting to be used to achieve some stretch goal, that was the last element of behavioral therapy to historically show up. So and so there are, so the initial books that covered exposure therapy were like the classic is Edna Foa, Stop Obsessing. There's another book called Don't Panic. Which is all about panic disorders, the older treatment, but it works. So the nice thing we know is that just challenging yourself to approach triggers works. The next move is mindfulness and acceptance. So the classic book on that is by Eifert and Forsyth called The Mindfulness and Acceptance Workbook for Anxiety. So, and that's a wonderful way of how do you more mindfully engage the alarm? And then the last approach is adds reframing. That's seen in books like Wendy Suzuki's Good Anxiety or Kelly McGonigal, The Upside of Stress. Jeremy Jameson has published things on this. So there's a more recent, the most recent move then in psychology and treating anxiety is all about reframing it and reframing adrenaline and utilizing adrenaline for growth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing, so.
Yeah, that's a great overview, and I'm excited to dive into those two in future episodes. So just maybe pulling back to get back to the first question of engaging the trigger and habituation and the challenge. Well, maybe a more basic question. Does anxiety always have a specific trigger? Or I remember watching a movie recently, and one of the characters says, you know, I just have this fear, but I don't know what it's of, or I don't know what it's about. And then the person said, yeah, that's anxiety. So
yeah,
is that,
that Barbie?
Well, I didn't want to say that, but fine.
Yes.
So is that accurate?
So this idea of free floating anxiety is a little, I think it's actually impossible. So our emotions, also called passions, are in some way passive. So they're always triggered. So you don't have emotions without a trigger. You might not be aware, or you might not admit what the trigger is. And sometimes what happens is there are, you can think of anxiety when people particularly have worries. Think of worrying as a tree, and that tree has twigs, and then little branches, and then boughs, and then a trunk. People might not admit the worry that is the trunk, but they might have a little more. They might just be aware, in fact, of the twigs. There's all these little things that worry them. So it seems free-floating, but just because they're staying at the outer level. If they could admit, what would be the way, and this is actually a question you could ask, when you're worrying or when you feel the free-floating anxiety, what would it look like to push it up, to make it increase? And they will always be able to find a way. And they'll find what the trigger is, but it's just that they're so trained to try to be pushing down on the anxiety and make it go away that they're not even letting themselves look at the trigger. It just shows, in a sense, how avoidant they are of the triggers. So it can be, so this idea of so when people say that they're always anxious and always overwhelmed, well, in some sense, that means there's very low-hanging fruit. If I was working with them, I'd ask them, what would it be like to push up on this? If you push up on it, then quickly you'll have to see that, oh yeah, there's this one thought I'm having. Okay, and you don't have to get to the trunk to do good work. You could do work with any area, any level of trigger. It doesn't have to be the deepest, darkest thing. As long as it seems accessible, it's a great place to start working. And the way you do therapy, there's two big different types of exercises that you can do with patients. One of them is in vivo exposures. And that's where you have the person go to the mall and actually sing at the top of their lungs off key in the food court. And that's what they did back in the 70s. We found that in vivo exposures, they do not fail. They work, but it's not even necessary, because really people are afraid of their thoughts. Your amygdala can't tell the difference between the real situation and a vivid thought of that situation. In fact, being in the real situation only makes your thoughts of it in that moment more vivid, and that's what your amygdala is detecting. So even when you're in a real situation, it's just that your thoughts of that situation are not particularly vivid because you're in it. But you could make them particularly vivid even without being in it. And we do that all the time if we're thinking about a future thing that we're afraid of. If you've ever experienced dread, you know how vivid it can be to have a thought of something that's not present. Well, we use that to do what are called imaginal exposures. And the imaginal exposure that's the simplest is you write down in one sentence the thing you're afraid of. It can be surprisingly powerful. Now, I've done this with people all the time. And I remember doing this once on my own. I thought, well, there was something that I was a little bit concerned about. So I just wrote down the concern that I had. And I started reading it again and again. And immediately I felt nauseous. I wasn't expecting nausea. Yeah, I didn't. But that, as I kept on reading into it, I was able to to welcome the sensations. And then very quickly, I couldn't get anything more out of it. I tried pushing up on that particular thought, and it kind of broke. The fact is that if you have anxiety that can be triggered just by thinking something, it is perfectly safe to just think that thing. The easiest way to do it is you write it down. And the reason you have people write it down, and this is a funny thing about worries, is that if you don't, your brain will play a trick on you. It will keep switching the thought. And so you never can habituate any one thought, because It'll be, my boss will be angry and I'll be fired. And then my friends will be, you know, not wanting to hang out with me anymore. And, but they keep going between those three thoughts. And they could do it again and again and again to such extent that they can never habituate any one of them. Some of the tricks we learned is having a person write down a thought gives you a chance to do a scientific exposure in that it's reproducible. They read it again and again and again. And as they do that, they just welcome the sensation of anxiety that comes. This kind of work is all about feeling the fear until it's gone. So you welcome it and welcome it, at least until it's below a four. There are other ways of doing like thought exposures, but just the sentence exposure gives a proof of concept and a lot of times lets people see that in fact, the things that they're afraid of can be changed and they're changed by approaching if the alarm is sounding.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's great. It sounds kind of painful. So I kind of have two follow-up.
It is.
Okay, good. I have two follow-up questions on that. One is, do you find that when someone comes to you and you're helping them, that they kind of have an endless supply of triggers and maybe it feels overwhelming? It's like, okay, I'm going to have to like go confront these triggers and provoke my anxiety, you know, every day for the rest of my life. I mean, I don't want to live this way. So, mm-hmm. Or do you find that, it's actually generally when people are anxious, there's maybe one main trigger or five or six, and you can mm-hmm. kind of work through them and then it generally goes away.
I think that if people have tons of triggers, it's that they're at the level of twigs. If they got to the bough level, there would be a few. And if they get to the trunk level, there's one. So that's a general idea, that people tend to have few real triggers. So it can happen with things like scrupulosity. So OCD is when people have a phobia of irrational thoughts that they admit are irrational most of the time. And so a common way of that shown is scrupulosity, where people have moral worries that they know aren't valid, but it still seems like it's so hard, you know, it can seem when people are fighting with scrupulosity that there are an endless supply of scruples. But in fact, you can get it more simple, you know, and you can get down to the thought, which is like, I have committed a mortal sin. So, I've deliberately done, you know, something bad. So you can generally get it down to one common theme. And just doing an exposure to that more common one can still produce the high anxiety. But if it didn't in one case, then you just go to some other one. You go to like an easier, more accessible one. It's not about choosing the perfect trigger. It's about actually getting experience with safety learning to see that whatever the trigger might be, if you can reproduce it again and again in the same way, it habituates. And the more eager you are to push up on your anxiety while doing that, the more quickly it habituates. So I think that this gets people then ready to be daring, to be like ready to take on more and more challenges. And that's the most beautiful thing you see when you actually do exposure therapy with people in this brutal way of just having them, you know, find a trigger and reproduce it till the anxiety is gone. They get this incredible sense of like, wow, I could do this. This has been holding me back for so long. I can do this with anything. And sometimes you have people then that really progress to the next level on their own. And that next level is daring, where now they're just eager to keep the alarm sounding so that they can keep practicing it. And that's the next level.
Right, which we'll go into more next week. Okay, last question. So in this stage, we're talking about that maybe someone is in this state of despair, which is basically they don't believe that they'll overcome the anxiety, that it's just a permanent trait of themselves. And so they kind of create the conditions in their life where they won't have to face the trigger. So they put up boundaries in different ways. So that in a sense creates more convenience or comfort. Whereas what we're encouraging people to do is like something kind of painful. Hey, you have to engage these triggers. You have to experience the fear. So how do you talk people or encourage people to go from one to the other, that the pain is worth it, even though you've kind of set up these boundaries to create comfort and avoid the triggers? How do you encourage them to engage those triggers?
It depends on the person. But if you start to explore, how has it been working for you to be avoiding this thought or avoiding this type of trigger, to avoid this experience? And then what's been the cost of that avoidance? So one of the gentle ways of doing that work is you help people to admit the cost that's been there. And then to see, have you ever tried the opposite? To, instead of avoiding this kind of thing, deliberately bring it on. And in general, people have. They might have done it in little ways. They might not have really noticed what was happening, but it happened. So most of the time, people already have experience that there were things they were afraid of in the past that they just didn't give themselves permission to avoid. And they got over it. For most people, driving is a great example of that. I think in general, it is a scary experience to be driving for the first time on a highway. And yet we all got through it. And it got less and less and less. If we thought about it carefully, maybe we could admit, yeah, it did get less and less over time, but it was pretty quick. Because you were perfectly fine feeling that anxiety. And there was no social stigma attached to feeling that kind of anxiety. And you got used to it right away. So I think people can see that when they were willing to have the anxiety be there, they could keep approaching the trigger and it just on its own habituated. This is a strategy that cannot fail. Approaching triggers while your alarm is sounding will produce safety learning and it will free you from that particular trigger. The next step then is seeing how, in general, the willingness to let your alarm sound makes even the alarm itself more and more easy to handle. And then finally, it can actually make it enjoyable when you learn to utilize the adrenaline it's giving you.
Wonderful. Well, Kevin, we're basically out of time here, so.
All right. Until next time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.